you.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And it's a very nice and pleasant surprise to see so many of you here at 8 o'clock in the morning. I just wanted to, as you've seen, there's a number of other people from the British Embassy here. After my presentation, which will probably be about 15 or 20 minutes, we'll endeavour to answer questions that you have, and hopefully with the assembled team here, we should be able to do a reasonable job of answering questions. This is all on the record. One other announcement. We're going to be doing another presentation on the Energy Review on the Hill next Monday, and Erin at the back will have further details if you have any colleagues who might be interested in that. Depending on how this presentation goes, it'll be an identical presentation, so you don't need to go to both, I hope. Well, thank you very much, and sorry, just let's go on to the first slide. As I say, it'll probably be about 15, 20 minutes. I think what I should do, really, before getting into the substance of the review is explain why this review was necessary. As some of you may know, we published a rather far-reaching energy white paper in 2003 covering the perspective over the next couple of decades. But in the intervening couple of years, a number of developments have taken place which caused us to want to review where we are. And indeed, the white paper of 2003 envisaged regular updates, particularly in order to track our progress against the various targets, energy targets, efficiency targets, and climate change targets we'd set ourselves. I think first, on climate change, over the last 2 years, there has really been a steady stream, almost week by week, of new evidence on the science, which has certainly in the UK led to growing concern. And you now have, politically in the UK, all three major parties in Westminster actually vying, indeed almost competing with each other, to bring forward initiatives to tackle the problem. And the government, who have been obviously focused on this for the past few years, are determined to make sure that they are living up to the targets that they have set for the UK. And on that, we're certainly on course to meet our Kyoto targets. We're also taking measures to ensure that we meet our even more ambitious national targets. Secondly, obviously, rising prices. In 2003, when the white paper was published, oil prices were around $30 a barrel. Now they're obviously over 70, and that's had a significant impact on energy policy in the UK. Thirdly, the growing UK dependence on imports of fossil fuels, and particularly, therefore, on international energy markets to deliver them. And recent experience has shown us that these international markets, the EU market in particular, is not as competitive as it should be and hasn't worked as well as we would have liked it to have worked. And also that these international markets are not as free, indeed the EU market as well, not as free from political influence from suppliers as we might wish. Obviously the recent events around in Ukraine at the beginning of the year are case in point. And the fourth major reason is the fact that our infrastructure is coming up for a renewal. Many of our coal plants and most of our nuclear plants will need to be replaced in the next 10 to 15 years if we're to maintain existing generation capacity. Next slide. Which takes us to the review that was published last week on the 11th of July. The review identifies on the back of this two main challenges, which are listed here on the slide. We're only going to really scratch the surface of the review itself today. It's an extensive document which is available. We have the executive summaries, but the full document is available on the website. But just two general points, I think, to start with. First, our work in the UK is on track, but obviously not yet complete. What you see today and in the review is our assessment of the problems and the main options we're focusing on in the UK and not the final recommendations. There are a number of processes coming out of the review that will lead to recommendations in another white paper on energy at the end of this year. Secondly, and obviously for this audience, energy is obviously an international issue. The review itself focuses mainly, though not entirely, on domestic policy options. But success is clearly going to depend a great deal on continuing to influence the international agenda on both climate change and energy security. And the conclusions from the review are closely linked to what the government is trying to do on the international scene. Next slide, please. Just to give you a sense of the challenge that we're facing in the UK and that is really the underlying rationale for many of the recommendations in the review, if you look at our emissions profile, the latest projections which are in the review show, as you can see from the slide, the projections up to 2050. And these are actually slightly worse than the projections that were recently published in the government's climate change program review. And one of the reasons for this is that the number of households is growing more rapidly than expected. I think the clear conclusion from this slide is that the current policy framework does not put us on a path to reduce our emissions, particularly if, as you can see, our target in 2050 is to reduce emissions by 60% of 1990 levels. That means down to 65 million tonnes of carbon. We're clearly going to be a long way from that on the basis of current projections. This chart doesn't include the savings from the EU emissions trading scheme, but that will not have a major impact on the profile, and the rest, therefore, will have to come if we're going to be focusing on this 2050 target from strengthening not only the existing frameworks but also adopting new ones, and the review makes a first stab at that. Again, some of the background in terms of the challenge, in terms of electricity generation, this chart again shows that the UK is going to need substantial new electricity generation capacity as coal and nuclear plants close, and that if we don't take active measures to do something about it, the diversity of our energy supplies for electricity will decline over the next 15 years, and our dependence on fossil fuels will increase. To give you the most clear example, under our current policy, if the recommendations of the review are not implemented, nuclear power will fall from 90% of our electricity generation today down to 6% by 2020. As existing plants reach the end of their operating life. Now, this is a similar challenge to what you're seeing here in the US, and obviously the ability of natural gas to fill the gap remains a closely watched issue and an international strategic issue as well. Next slide, thank you. Again, looking at the background to the review, the risks from increased dependence on imported gas. The UK is one of the most gas-dependent economies in Europe. We have just over 40% of our electricity generation comes from gas-fired power stations. What this chart shows is a sharp decline in UK gas production to the extent that we estimate on current trends be importing over 80% of our gas supplies by 2020. That will... we'll see basically about a third of our gas coming from the North Sea and the Netherlands. But because gas reserves are concentrated outside of Europe, we'll increasingly need to look further afield to secure those supplies. A lot more of our gas is going to come from liquefied natural gas, where we're obviously extending our infrastructure, and we think about a third of that will come by ship in the future. And the remaining third will come from pipelines from Europe, where, again, there's an extensive infrastructure program, particularly linking us more effectively to Norway and to the continent. Again, these are issues that you in the US are also dealing with. Turning now to the actual review's recommendations, I'd like to start first with the obvious point, really, which is that climate change, which is a driver at the centre of this review, is an issue that has to be tackled internationally. Clearly, we need an effective international framework for doing this, and we in the UK very much believe that we need to be looking at the scheme that's going to operate when the current UN negotiated agreement runs out in 2012 and ideally agree a follow-on regime soon. Our building block for this, and if you like, what we see as the hub for global action, is the European Union's emission trading scheme. This creates a carbon price, which is key to incentivizing cost-efficient abatement on supply and demand side. And it's also, we believe, a model for other international trading programs. And therefore, we see the ETS as a key platform underpinning all of our climate change and carbon reduction ambitions going forwards. And the review actually focuses in some detail on how we would like to see the ETS develop. And in particular, I think the most newsworthy commitment in the review or recommendation in the review is that the UK should be asking the European Union to consider bringing surface transport within the remit of the European Emission Trading Scheme. Next slide, please. Energy efficiency and reducing demand for fossil fuels is a clear objective in the review. The review has sets out a rather wide-ranging and ambitious package of measures on energy efficiency. These are about trying to change behaviour, which is always difficult, and it's difficult to necessarily predict the outcomes, although we believe that it does remain one of the low-hanging fruit of this process, and that possibly energy efficiency could account for up to half of our carbon savings by 2020. So next slide, please. Looking again now at transport, microgeneration, and distributed power, again, a number of significant recommendations in the review. Taking the recommendations to promote technologies that will lead to a more efficient transport sector and to fuel switching, one of the central planks of that is the renewable transport fuel obligation. At the moment, that is set to rise to 5% by 2010, and we want to, beyond that, raise it still further. We also are actively working to bring aviation emissions into the emissions trading scheme. Focusing now on microgeneration, distributed energy, a number of measures in the review, again, to push this forward, a lot of them focusing on local government. For example, empowering the Mayor of London to put forward plans to minimise carbon emissions in London by increased use of microgeneration and distributed energy systems, and also measures to encourage all local authorities to require a percentage of energy to come from renewable microgeneration and distributed sources. Next slide, please. Coming now to the issue of replacing our electricity generation capacity. Just to give you a sense of the challenge, the UK needs to build around 25 to 30 gigawatts of new capacity over the next 15 to 20 years. That is, in effect, around a third of today's existing capacity. That's clearly an opportunity if we can encourage companies to bring forward more low-carbon investments in the next 15 to 20 years. Then we'll be banking carbon savings for 20 to 40 years thereafter. But obviously the converse is true, and for each new unabated fossil fuel plant, we'll be locking in higher carbon emissions for, again, decades to come. So the review looks at how we can make our policy framework not only carbon-friendly, but also an effective driver for encouraging new clean investment to come forward in a timely way, and I'll come back to that in a moment. In terms of how we would actually do this, we're looking in particular at ensuring that the investment framework in the UK provides as much certainty as possible. The sort of issues that we focus on in the review include improving the flow of information to companies seeking to invest in energy projects, reinforcing our commitment to a carbon price, removing barriers to investment in low-carbon technologies. And we hope that by establishing a strategic context through the review and the white paper and introducing efficient inquiries and ensuring timely decision-making, this will strengthen the investment framework going forwards. Turning now in particular to nuclear, which is what has attracted most of the media attention from the review in the United Kingdom, I think it's probably fair to say that the review is not as aggressive as the sort of incentives that you saw put forward in the US Energy Policy Act in 2005. The review proposes that the government should announce that nuclear will play a role in the UK's future generating mix as an important source of low-carbon generation. The government should therefore, the review recommends, take forward facilitating measures, including focusing on pre-licensing and planning, which are obviously issues that you've been dealing with here in the US. But we've made very clear that First of all, this is not about extending necessarily our nuclear, the percentage of our electricity that we get from nuclear. It's about maintaining it going forwards. And secondly, that it'll be for the private sector to initiate, fund, build, and operate these new plants. There will be no special subsidies for nuclear, and we've been making that very clear both before and since the review was published. In terms of decommissioning, again, developers will also need to satisfy government they have made secure arrangements for this and for covering an appropriate share of the waste costs. On nuclear in particular, there's going to be a consultation process, particularly on the planning and pre-licensing issues that that have been identified in the review, which will conclude at the end of October. Looking now at renewables and cleaner coal, on renewables, we're considering strengthening the UK renewables obligation. What that means in practice is increasing the target from 15% to 20% of our capacity to come from renewables by around 2020. Also, we're going to be looking at possible changes to our planning regime in order to, in particular, help major onshore projects which have been, like here, bedeviled by local planning issues. On carbon capture and storage, I think the review recognises that this is unlikely to be implemented on a large scale in the next 10 years, but that it is a crucial technology in the longer term, especially globally where, in, for example, China, they're building 1 gigawatt of new coal plant each week. The next steps in the UK, as the review highlights, could be a demonstration, which obviously would be expensive. We believe it's in the order of probably £100 million for each demonstration project, but it's something that we're very keen to do. In terms of the actual renewables obligation, that was the renewables target. In 2003, the Energy White Paper established a 10% by 2010 goal for electricity supply from renewable sources. And, as I say, the review proposes to strengthen that. Sorry, next slide, please. In terms of enhancing more widely the UK's security of supply, the review makes a number of proposals on that as well. First of all, we're going to be working with the industry to boost investment in the UK continental shelf over the next 15 years, irrespective of oil and gas prices, try and ensure that there is more investment coming in to ensure that our supply from the North Sea continues. Secondly, we're going to convene something that a coal forum to find solutions to secure the long-term future of coal-fired generation and UK coal productions, which will bring together the major stakeholders, the coal producers, the coal-fired generators, and other interested parties. We're also going to be consulting over the autumn on how to improve the planning process for gas supply infrastructure. We'll also examine how to improve the effectiveness of current gas security of supply arrangements, such as adjusting gas storage levels and requirements for backup supplies and so on. Next slide, please. So looking at what we think the impact of all of this will be in terms of carbon savings, the review estimates that if the proposals are outlined in the review and are implemented, we will see something like 69 million tonnes of carbon saved from energy efficiency by 2020, at least 8 million tonnes from the EU ETS, 2 to 3 million tonnes from transport, 1 to 3 million tonnes from cleaner electricity, and 2 to 3 million tonnes from tighter building regulations. Next slide, please. In terms of improved energy security, overall, we believe these measures will reduce projected 2020 gas consumption by 11 to 17%. Next slide. And in terms of the issue of higher prices and the issue of fuel poverty, which is a significant political issue in the UK, the review sets out where we think this will have an impact in alleviating those issues. Just lastly, before turning over to questions, in terms of the next steps, I mean, one of the things that the review does do is set out a number of consultation processes. This is by no means the final word in this discussion. As you can see, there's a number of consultations that will be ongoing over the next few months. They will probably all converge on the energy white paper, which will come out at the end of the year, which will actually provide conclusions for the consultations and actually set out precisely what the government intends to do on the back of the review. So the final recommendations in terms of government policy will be another probably 6 months, 5 to 6 months away, but the review gives obviously a very clear indication of which direction we're going. Final slide. Just to finish off, there's in terms of more information, the review itself is on the DTI's website at the following link, and again, there's further information more generally on the British Embassy website, which is also on this slide. Thank you very much for listening, and we're very happy, myself and my team, to answer any questions you may have on the back of that presentation or any other more general questions in terms of the UK's energy policy going forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. That was it's going to put everybody else to shame in terms of the comprehensiveness, the clarity, the forward-looking, the scope, the ambitiousness of the U.S., the U.K. commitment. And I think we wish you well, since we're not that far along, clearly, but it's really quite helpful. I just wanted to, before going to general, two quick questions just for clarification, both on the supply side. The slide 5 talked about other natural gas imports, and I maybe didn't understand that. I was wondering if that top bar is other gas. Or is that other imports of some kind? Whether or not that includes Russian gas, is that where that that chunk of gas, since you have LNG separated out, it may be, I may be misinterpreting this, and it may be a clear explanation, but I was trying to understand whether other sources of gas were going to come from other than LNG in Norway and maybe some from the continent.
I think our estimate is that something like 13% by 2020 of our gas will come from Russia.
From Russia.
But we'll still be largely dependent in terms of our foreign imports on Norway, right. And we're building a new pipeline to ensure that we can maintain that supply. And obviously then through the North Sea interconnector, yep, with the continent, but again, indirectly, that's where the Russian gas will come from.
Okay. Right. The other was a nuclear question in terms of the ambitiousness of the nuclear program. Some of these nuclear programs that are coming to the marketplace now are going to be based on new technology, and there's always new technology penetration issues. Was that looked at in terms of this, or is that part of the consultation in preparation for the next stage of the plan in terms of how fast you can bring advanced technology, nuclear, to the marketplace and have it up and running?
Well, I think our approach is similar to yours in that we will be trying to pre-license some of the existing reactor technologies, so that it's a faster and more simple process in terms of the utilities going forwards. In terms of the more advanced technologies, sort of the GNAP type technologies, there's a separate discussion going on, and we in the UK are very interested in the GNAP process. And I think there's a number of meetings taking place between the UK and the US over the next few weeks. We'll see just what our involvement in that will be. But GNAP's clearly a very interesting way of doing that.
Great, thank you. Okay, we're open for questions. Yeah.
I was looking at your numbers for renewables, and I understand in the US where we get them from, for better or worse. And I understand in Brazil where we get them from. Where in England are you going to get these renewables to make up this, in what form will they be in, and will the government subsidy?
The main ones have been to do with offshore wind and now increasingly onshore wind. And I think we installed last year two times the wind capacity that we'd installed in 2004. So there's an accelerated program of bringing on wind generation. In terms of the detail, in terms of other technologies and the fiscal framework, Christian, have you got any more details on that?
I think going forward, offshore wind is the key. We obviously, the onshore wind existing has all the usual problems with onshore wind. We're a windy little island off the north coast of Europe, so the plan is going forward. We're not stipulating precise, we're not saying we expect X Singapore's renewables obligation and let the market bring which technologies. But on current trends, offshore wind is going to be critical. In terms of our expertise, we're also really in the centre of excellence for the early work on tidal wave technology. Well, that's sort of research phase, so that's further out. But I think if that evolves with the sort of UK as a world leader.
Thank you. Thanks, Julian, for your presentation. Just a bit on the review process. It was strictly done by HMG, no outside participants at that time.
That's, the process was run by HMG, it's run by the Department of Trade and Industry. Okay. There was a consultation process, and the consultation document was published earlier in the year, and I think we got something like 5,300 submissions from across the UK and actually internationally, and those were analysed by the DTI review team, but also there was a consultant brought in at that stage to help with the process of integrating the comments into the review process. So, as I say, led by the DTI, some consultancy support and a consultation process that led to a lot of substantive comment coming in from a range of quarters.
And there was a fairly open process?
Yeah, I suppose by British government standards, pretty open. it was run by the policy lead ministry and by the permanent civil service, as I say, with a consultation.
Yeah. There was a reason for asking that question.
Yeah, I think you said in your answer to Al that you saw about 13% of your gas supply coming from Russia in about 2020, was it? Does that imply a role for Gazprom in the downstream?
Well, this is the big issue that obviously came up a couple of months ago, and Gazprom are certainly interested in buying downstream assets throughout the European Union. They have already bought some assets in the United Kingdom. They're very interested in Centrica, which is our main domestic company. And we have at a sort of the level of policy and principle said that, you know, that Gazprom will be treated no differently from any other foreign investor. There's a framework for dealing with such investments, and they will be applied to Gazprom as to anybody else. We'll see what happens next. It's clearly something that has raised concern in some quarters and has raised concern elsewhere in Europe. We do spend a lot of our time elsewhere in the world arguing in favour of open markets and bringing down barriers to international investment, including here in the United States. Sometimes we have to consider living by those rules back in the UK.
Listening to your presentation, it appears it's a climate change presentation. 90% of your presentation was a carbon presentation. And in the dictionary, energy doesn't have anything to do with that. How are you dealing with supply? Because it appears yours is a reduction of demand, and the world is increasing demand. China and India and the rest of them, including the United States, and including maybe Europe, not maybe to the same extent. Is how are you factoring in what we call energy security in your program as opposed to being a carbon presentation?
Well, I think in terms of climate change is one of the major drivers of our energy policy. I mean, that's much more explicit in the UK than it is here. And it is, in terms of the politics of energy policy in the UK, it's if not the most high-profile issue, it's one of them. In terms of the security of supply, I think the review does go through in some detail, and I'd certainly commend you to look at the detailed chapters on security of supply in terms of looking at how we can basically diversify our supplies of energy. I don't think anyone in the UK is arguing that we can try to be to reduce our independence and our dependence on imports, but we just need to increase our diversity of supply and ensure that we're not dependent on any one particular source predominantly. And the investment in infrastructure, particularly on the gas side, I think is very much part of that. The LNG terminals that will give us wider options in terms of where we can source our gas from, being a case in point, improving the pipeline infrastructure to the United Kingdom, improving the workings of the European Union single market to ensure that that works as an effective competitive market. And the Commission is carrying out an investigation on our behalf into why that didn't work so effectively over the winter when demand for gas went up significantly in the UK, prices spiked, and we didn't get the flow through of gas from the continent that you would have expected in a single market. So there's a range of policies that I think do address that. I think it is true that certainly the focus in the UK has been in particular on climate change and on nuclear, which again, if you could argue, certainly is a security of supply issue, where we want to maintain at least 20% share of our electricity generation from domestic nuclear.
Gene, can I just add, because I think it's a very important question that goes to the heart of what this review and the previous white paper was all about. We are rewriting the dictionary definition of energy security by saying you cannot have an energy policy and you cannot think about energy security without thinking about the carbon policy at the same time. The fact that the first chapter in this review is about carbon challenge and carbon pricing, I think it's very deliberate, not because it's an obsession of Tony Blair, although it is. It's by saying that without a clear carbon lens and the need to put a price on carbon, you can't think sensibly about how you need to drive the different technologies which flow. Energy at one side, energy efficiency coin, is a carbon one. The other side is an energy security one. And I think it's a very deliberate lens for our policy to see both as totally important.
Yeah, I was going to ask, it's a two-prong. One is about, this gentleman asked about the biofuels. The source within the UK for developing those biofuels. That would be a great one, because we're looking for various alternative sources in the United States. And then secondly, you had up there about cooperation with the United States and coal technology. There are several universities very near here doing extensive research.
Certainly. I mean, on biofuels, I think it's clear that the US is much further advanced than we are, and indeed the extent to which the UK is going to be growing its own domestic biofuels is going to be limited. I mean, we just don't have the agricultural space to do that on a significant scale. There is clearly a role for imported biofuels, and so I think we'll be looking at the trading environment, really, and for that, and ensuring that that's as efficient as possible, and that there's as few barriers to that as possible. When Alistair Darling, our Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, was over here a month ago, he had a very interesting conversation over at DOE with Secretary Bodman, in which the Secretary was setting out what you're doing in terms of developing the technologies, particularly for cellulosic ethanol, and looking at a one-step process and so on. I think we're very interested in that, and Alistair Darling is very keen that the Department of Trade and Industry follow up, and the UK government follow up with you on that research. So I think that's an area that we will be looking at. On clean coal and cooperating with the United States, I mean, these technologies are very much part of a number of international collaborative processes underway at the moment. There's the Glen Eagles Dialogue that we established during our G8 presidency last year, which does involve the G8 countries plus the five large developing countries, China, India, Mexico, South Africa, and Brazil, looking at a range of clean energy technology, and clean coal technologies are very much part of that. And the next meeting will be in October, I believe, in Mexico, and we'll be looking particularly at those issues. The EU is also working with the Chinese, for example, in looking at developing a commercial demonstration project there. I know the US is doing something similar through the Asia-Pacific Partnership. So there are a number of strands to this. We think the Glen Eagles Dialogue is particularly important because it actually brings them together, and we think that's essential that there's that we try and do it in as joined up a way as possible.
We'll go down this way. Okay. Yeah. You mentioned this point of concern about pipeline supply gas from Europe, and at the same time you envision a future where there is more and more pipeline supply from Europe, including Russian gas supply. Are you concerned about cartelization of the European pipeline infrastructure, and how do you deal with that as a policy?
We are very much. Over the winter, the demand, we had a very cold winter in the UK, and demand increased significantly. It turned out that our coal-fired plants, which usually provide about a third of our demand for electricity, ended up having to provide 50% because we were unable to get the gas from the continent. Although prices were spiking in the UK, the interconnector with the continent, the interconnector pipeline, was only running at 60% capacity. So something wasn't working in the European single market. Now, energy market liberalisation in the European Union is still a work in progress, let's put it that way. And what we have asked the Commission to do is investigate why the market didn't work in the way it should have worked and to take action. And there are a number of strands to that. The Commission's has been carrying out an investigation into this. Their initial report identifies a number of flaws in the market. They're also carrying out infraction proceedings against a number of energy companies across the European Union. So really we see the European Commission as our ally in driving through this process and ensuring that the market in practice lives up to what we've all signed up to in law. The issue of the dependence then of the European market on Russian gas is a wider question, one in which we believe you have to address by ensuring that you have infrastructure in place that give you alternatives to Russian gas going forward, and a lot of that comes down to LNG. It may come down to pipelines as well.
Well, my question somehow is related tangentially to it. But in the first slide, you mentioned that while the UK is based on its markets, it has to deal with countries where competitiveness is not its main priority. And as we see that national oil companies become more and more significant suppliers of oil and energy resources for West. How do you think politically this is going to play out, and what type of political implementations are there? Would some of these national oil companies might act for ideological or other reasons, or nationalist reasons in the future, for instance, like Venezuela also?
Yeah, I mean, that is a major concern. I mean, there are national oil companies and there are national oil companies. I mean, Statoil is fine because it operates in a transparent manner and a competitive manner. And I think our focus is really on the way in which the companies operate. If they do operate transparently and according to competitive market principles, who owns it for us is not the issue. However, most national oil companies, of course, are not like that. And this is an issue that we think we need to address by ensuring that the actual principles of the markets are that all of the players in those markets operate according to market principles, rather than by taking issue particularly with the percentage of national ownership of any particular company. This is clearly going to be a problem going forwards. But again, the focus is bringing in those countries into an international market-based system, an international trading system, whereby they will be playing by international market rules. Bringing Russia into the WTO, for example, will be part of that process. And that's why these negotiations have been, in many ways, so difficult. It's about trying to ensure that the countries that do have these major national oil companies that are going to be major players going forwards are stakeholders in an international economic system which is based on market principles, and that includes energy.
On that thread, maybe a little bit further, Julian, in two directions: price forecasts, and then your backup plan if your erstwhile efforts on markets doesn't quite pan out. You've highlighted the stickiness of the markets. That's going to happen in the future. We saw it here with the dash to gas in the late 90s, and we got burned by it. All of our price forecasts were way under. We're looking at 2 and 3X now. You could be facing the same thing. You haven't mentioned prices in any of the slides. What is the price outlook under different scenarios? And then what kind of backup plans are you pursuing if you run into the same situation we did?
Well, just coming to the second part of your question first, I think the answer to your first question is that our forecasts are no better than anybody else's forecasts, and those are all over the place. So coming back to the second part of your question, I think the reason that nuclear is now a serious issue and is politically as a real political possibility in the UK again is because actually public opinion has been exposed to the reality that international prices, particularly for oil and gas, obviously are unpredictable. They're going up. There's consequences to that, and we need to have other sources of supply for our energy, including things like nuclear, which 5-10 years ago would have not have been politically possible to look at again.
But your future backup plans can't hinge on an EU Commission investigation. That's something better.
Right, which is why we're trying to ensure that we reduce our dependence on imported natural gas, and that's, if going back to the slide that showed the impact of the review, we believe that we will reduce our dependence on imported natural gas by about 17-20% as a result of those measures.
And the price assumptions for settling panics we've got on the website. How's a full overview of the model and the price assumptions that
we're going in the U.S. Department of Energy models for 2015, they address the natural gas issue in electricity by emphasizing the growing importance of integrated coal to gas power generation. And with carbon sequestration, as part of that process, it seems that that would be a very logical thing for the UK to be doing as well, and that I don't get the sense that that's part of this plan.
I mean, to be fair, I think it is certainly something that we're obviously following. That BP has been in many ways pioneering, not least up in Scotland. In terms of government subsidy and so on at this stage, I don't think we're heavily investing in that. But Christian, in terms of what the review says specifically on that, is there anything?
It's underpinned several of the questions. We all tend to focus on one of the technologies. Do we need CCS? Where those biofuels come from? What are we going to do with the gas problem if prices get sticky? And the clear answer in the review is slightly dull, is we've got to do it all. We can't rely on any of these. We need the whole suite. So, I mean, the piece on CCS is clear. This is a technology that has huge potential, obviously critical if we continue our reliance on coal. And if you look at the slide that showed the forecast for coal as part of electricity mix 2050 is about the same as it is now. So if we have climate concerns, CCS is going to be crucial, but we think there's a lot more of the demonstration phase which is needed before we can give the kind of signal to say that we are on.
Can you elaborate a little bit on how the funding allocation within the Environmental Transportation Fund is likely to take place, the likely technology recipients there, how the politics on that evolves? That's something that's not that transparent.
I'm not sure what the review actually says in terms of the detail of that, but I think it's one of the issues that's part of the consultation process is going forward in terms of how that's actually going to work.
So when the consultation process completes and that white paper is completed at the end of this year, it would say more about how the incentives or subsidies within that fund would be allocated and over the years?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
So I believe you projected that you become a net oil importer by 2010. Do you anticipate creating strategic petroleum reserves after that, if you actually do?
I think the main focus in the review is actually trying to extend the life of the North Sea continental shelf and address in particular the investment concerns, particularly of major oil companies about long-term investment in the North Sea. And I know that the Treasury are looking, again, at the fiscal framework in order to ensure that companies continue to invest there, and therefore that we maintain our capacity from the North Sea for as long as possible. And that is the main focus at this stage, but clearly it's going to be an issue over the next decade or so that we're going to have to come back to.
You mentioned that there would be no government incentives for the construction of nuclear generation. I presume
then your content of that generation will get built and maintained at least 20% of the current generation base?
Well, that's, I mean, we'll see what happens as a result of this consultation that ends in at the end of October. But EDF, the French company, have said that on the basis of what they've heard so far, they would be interested in building nuclear plants in the United Kingdom.
The review is, just to jump in, the review is very explicit. It says, quote, any new nuclear power station will be proposed, developed, constructed, and operated by the private sector would also need decommissioning and a full share of long-term waste management costs. The assumptions about whether or not that will come forward are in part based on a forecast of the carbon price of the gas price.
Probably by 2020, although there's a number of elements to that. And there's this concept of sort of guaranteed headroom, that you move to the 20% when it becomes necessary in order to you know, when you, the, if you like, the technology and the demand are such that by moving to that 20%, you then see a real take-up of those technologies. The other issue we're looking at is banding within the renewables obligation in order to move out, if you like, the more commercially established technologies now and move in those that we're seeking to develop and bring closer to the market. So there's a number of strands to how we're going to take the renewables obligation forward.
I believe you are projecting a decrease in CO2 emissions from transportation, personal transportation. In your model, how much of that is from behavioral changes versus technological improvements?
In terms of the detail of that, I don't know, Christian, if you've seen the modelling, if that's
mostly,
it divides that out.
I think it's safe to say that the transportation piece of the CO2 mix is still the huge challenge, both in relation to aviation emissions, where we, as you know, are trying to get aviation European trading scheme and road transport. The proposals in this review and the figures for setting is 2 to 3 million tons by 2020 come almost primarily from the fuels and from improvements in vehicle efficiency. But it reads somewhere the most sort of used word in throughout the review, and I haven't got the number of times to hand, is on changing public awareness.
Changing
public awareness.
Ah, okay.
And so peppered throughout the entire document is this emphasis that we have to change behaviour. So it almost underpins everything. We've got the specific proposals on transport. You're absolutely right. It's the technology changes both on the fuels and on the vehicles.
Congratulations, Julian. Oh, I'm sorry, one more. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. So you get a short question for that reason.
Following on to the issue of green aviation up to the ETS, can you comment at all on whether there's any discussion of setting fuel efficiency standards or how you actually get the aircraft to more efficient?
There's sort of an ongoing debate. This is probably our ambition is to get aviation into the second phase of the ETS, which probably means by 2010. The Commission has been basically playing quite a tough game with the industry, saying that it's either we bring emissions into the trading scheme or we look at a tax, a European tax, and the industry as a result has been in favour of bringing emissions into the trading scheme. The discussions are still underway as to exactly how we would achieve that and quite how you'd apply that to the the industry itself. We're pretty much at an early stage, I think it's fair to say still.
I'm tempted to observe on aviation. I don't know what the status of the bilateral aviation agreement is, but it's been going on since blimps were crossing the Atlantic. But maybe this is another tariff barrier we'll have to deal with.
You may have an agreement by the end of the year.
Oh, good. Congratulations.
Maybe.
Hope it means cheaper airfares, right? Julian, thank you very, very much for coming and being so explicit and clear and thoughtful for all of us, and thank you for, to all of your team from the embassy for all of the work they did on behalf of helping us really understand what is a truly impressive and ambitious program for the UK government has launched. And I think that's something that I think we all can learn from. Please join me in thanking Julian and everyone.